Welcome back to Vocal Point. This is Jerry Newcomb, and right now we're going to be talking with a Baylor professor named Dr. Elizabeth Corey, and we'll be talking about the subject of women and balancing the issue of career and motherhood.
Yes, for sure.
Dr. Corey, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. Well, I asked my wife in preparation for this interview coming up, I said, what are your thoughts about this since you've dealt with this issue? And she said, well, I'm reminded of the old statement from Jesus in a different, slightly different context, but where he says, you can't serve two masters, you go crazy. So I thought that was an interesting comment from her. And you've written about this in First Things. Tell us about that article and your findings.
Well, sure. You know, that's an interesting way of introducing it, and I think she's on to something there. The essay that I wrote for First Things is called No Happy Harmony, and it is basically an exploration of a very current topic, which you've probably read about. It's this question of balance. Can women work and have families? And if they want to do both, how do they make it all work? And there are many, many essays and blog posts and all sorts of things written about this topic. But what I saw missing in the literature is a real recognition of the kinds of different, I would almost say, existential orientations these two activities require. On the one hand, professional work requires a kind of persistence and focus and emphasis on achievement and follow through and all these sorts of words that we're very accustomed to hearing. But what's not recognized is that motherhood, I think, requires a different set of what I would call virtues. A kind of willingness to set your own plans aside, to focus on the needs of someone else. It's a kind of sacrificial way of orienting yourself, which is not very often what's called for at work. Mm-hmm. And so the literature tends to sort of gloss over that and say, well, you need to kind of put it all on a long list and get it all done. And I wanted to say, well, actually, no, I think the two kinds of endeavors are quite different. And that's what the essay argues in sum.
Well, first of all, obviously we don't want to make anybody feel guilty if they're in the situation where, unfortunately, circumstances in life require or force them to have to be in the workplace when they have little children and they would actually prefer to focus on the children. On the other hand, and there is another hand, there are many today where they go out and do that because that's sort of become the cultural norm. They want the money, and they don't think there's going to be any deleterious effects of the children, especially if they're older than, I don't know, how old, maybe two or three or four or whatever.
Yes, I mean, I think you bring up an interesting point there. I mean, I should say at the outset that I am actually doing both endeavors. I'm teaching at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. I teach political science there, and I also have two children. So, I mean,
how old are your
children? The article, in a way, it says the two can't be balanced, but yet I'm balancing them. Well, how does that work?
How old are your children, Elizabeth?
They are not 8 and 6.
8 and 6. Okay. Well, that's not like, you know, in the just right there in the nursery. But go ahead.
No, it's not. But even at that, I mean, children, as you probably know, require quite a lot of attention.
Oh, yeah.
And focus, and you could certainly devote all your time to being a mother, and that's what I'm trying to point out, which is to say, you know, women can certainly do both, but what we fail to recognize at our peril is how different the endeavors are, and what very often happens with many women I know, indeed with myself, is that, you know, I come home and think, well, I need to, you know, stay in touch with my email, I need to keep going on the work that I started at at the university. But I think that's to really do a disservice to family. And so even just recognizing that...
Something happened with your phone that makes you not sound as good. Whatever changed.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds much better. Thanks. Go ahead.
Is that better?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So anyway, all I'm saying is that I think that it's important to recognize the differences between the two spheres and to make a break between them and not just treat your children as if they're one more thing on the to-do list that needs to be attended to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's true. What do you think the long-term effects are when children do get neglected and they effectively get raised or reared by daycare centers or whatever?
Well, again, there's a tremendous variety of options for daycare, and some, of course, are much better than others. I think children know, though, when they are being paid attention to, and whether that's a mother's attention, or, I mean, obviously we all, I think, probably would prefer to have it be a mother's or a parent's attention, but children are very attuned to whether or not adults are paying attention to them. And I think the most important thing for them is when they are with their parents, that those parents are paying attention, mm-hmm. not trying to multitask or do three yeah. things at once and sort of be with them, but sort of not be with them. And that's a real danger of our you know, being so technologically linked all yes. the time that we're always aware of, you know, and there's a new email that's come in, or I need to attend to something on my computer.
Sure.
And that's a benefit, because women can work from home to a large extent now.
Yes.
But on the other hand, it's a problem, because we're constantly pulled away from being present to our family by those diversions.
Very true. You know, and by the way, I think that is absolutely true for everybody in this society. In fact, I know a pastor who says, in reference to that, you know, people, they pull out their iPads or their iPhones or their smartphones or whatever, and they're constantly texting and so forth. But this pastor says this: wherever you are, be there. Oh, I think that's so true.
Yes.
So, and your point is that children can pick up on, you know, whether you really care or whether you don't.
Absolutely. And they do. And, you know, I can think of many instances where my son has said to me, you know, are you listening to me? And I'll have to kind of realize with a start, oh, you know, no, I really wasn't. And so I think that does a disservice to the children. But I think your pastor's right, too, that we need to do this with everyone, not just with children.
Sure.
I mean, adults and students are just, I mean, they're alike bad about the use of technology and then not focusing on the person that they're talking to. And we all are prone to this, not just women, not just mothers, of course. It's everyone. So recognizing that and making those distinctions and focusing on the person you're actually talking to is a huge part of being a good parent, in my view.
Now, unfortunately, the feminist movement, you know, let's say going back 30 or 40 years ago, there were some extreme elements that were key elements, though, where they were really downgrading motherhood. And I remember Betty Friedan in The Feminine Mystique, she likened being a full-time housewife and full-time mother or whatever. What she used the phrase comfortable concentration camp, which I thought, wow, that's
yes.
that's awfully bad taste.
Yeah, excuse me. That's remarkable, and I know of that sort of strand of feminism. I mean, in a certain sense, I think we've moved past that. So that when you read the modern feminist literature, it's usually the case that people will at least say, we believe that women ought to have a choice. If they want to stay home, they should be able to. And if they don't, if they want to work, they should be able to do that too. I think the real danger comes in the kind of assumptions that are sort of implicit in the modern conversation. It is said that women should be free to do whatever they want, but very often, who do we hear from? Well, we hear from the people who are working or the people who are engaged in the balancing act. And so the stay-at-home mothers sometimes get short shrift there.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, you know, superficially said, oh, this is great, but really down deep, they're made to feel like, well, why did you go to college? What did you do all this for if you're just going to stay at home? And I think that's a really mm-hmm. sort of pernicious influence and a very bad way of thinking about, one, what college ought to be for young women, but also it disrespects the idea that staying home is really a worthwhile thing and perhaps the most important job that some women are able to do.
Mm-hmm. And what about the concept of sequencing? That in this phase of life, we'll do this, and in that phase of life, we'll do that.
I love the idea. I think in practice, it's a little bit difficult. I can speak from the perspective of university professors. It's very hard to just opt out for those crucial years in, say, in your 30s, even late 20s, and then step back in, because very often there are plenty of people there who haven't stepped out, who are able to be, you know, at the place you would have been if you had taken the time away.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably there are certain careers that are more hospitable to that, but in theory, you know, you have to like that idea because it makes sense. It makes sense of a woman's biological clock. It makes sense of women,
sure.
very many women's desire to have children at a younger age. I mean, if that is a possibility, I think it's a great one.
Hmm. All right, we're talking right now with Elizabeth Corey, who is a professor at Baylor University. By the way, I have to tell you, there's a professor at Baylor that joined there from Princeton, and before that he was at the University of Pennsylvania. He is one of my favorite people. I just love him. His research is phenomenal. Dr. Byron Johnson, I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Yes, I know him.
Yeah, he's tremendous. I mean, he's done a lot of research on the impact of church going, for example, on people's lives. He's shown that that the global studies show that in America, if you go to church on a weekly basis and you're white, you add 7 years on average. And if you're black or an African American, you add 14 years on average. So, what happens when you're a mother?
It's quite remarkable, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. How does being a mother, are there any studies as far as being a mother is concerned in terms of, the impact of the quality of one's life? I'm just curious.
You know, that is a question I don't have an answer to. I'm sure there are. The short answer is I'm sure there are studies that would examine that. But probably, you read about the studies that say, well, married people are in the long term so much happier and
they live longer
lifespans.
And yeah.
There's got to be something similar, some kind of correlation between parenting. Of course, I suppose cynically you could say, well, parenting is stressful and it probably takes years off your life, but I imagine the effect goes the other way.
Sure, sure. Okay, we're talking right now again with Elizabeth Corey. Let me ask you a question, though. Where does the Christian faith tie into this? Because a lot of things that we're called to do can be, and sometimes are, directly countercultural, but it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, we're all going to give an account before Jesus and not the other way around.
Yes, that's a very important question to ask and to answer also. I think one way of thinking about it is the idea that, well, motherhood or parenting in general, not just motherhood, certainly fatherhood too, is a sacrificial activity. And in doing that activity, you are following the example of Christ, who obviously made the ultimate sacrifice.
Sure.
And so there's something noble about that in itself, whether or not you're recognized for being a good parent or, whether the world sees that as a praiseworthy activity. In the doing of it, you are doing good. And I think seems to me to be a pretty big movement of younger women, I would say 40 and under, who are devoutly religious and who have chosen to stay at home, and they're finding support on communities, on the internet and through blogs and that sort of thing. And so there's a strong Christian impetus toward sort of reinvigorating staying at home.
Sure.
The one thing I would say, I teach college, and so I'm dealing with lots of young women and of course men who are making decisions about their lives. And the other problem that motivated this essay was that, well, women want to do both, and very many women feel called, even in a Christian context, to do something in the world. So I have young women in my classes who want to become missionaries or who want to become doctors and go to Africa and do work for the sick and the ill. And, so they also are going to have to face this question of how to balance their desires to be mothers and wives with their desire to do something in the world. So there's no real simple answer to, well, what should young women in this day and age do? It's a very tough problem.
Mm. All right. Well, I have to admit, I've not read the essay. If I were to read the essay, what would it say that you have not said so far?
Well, it would criticize in a fairly gentle but sometimes pointed way the modern feminist writings on this subject. One of the things, I may have said this already, that prompted me to write the essay was the lack of treatment of the real sort of existential problem in a person's soul about how to balance these things. The modern feminist writing tends to say, well, we can solve the problems women feel by getting more women in government, or by reforming the workplace, or by having a woman president. I mean, they really do say these are the ways we'll solve this problem. And I'm for certain workplace reforms. I think that's all very good. But my point is that we cannot solve these problems politically, because these are existential problems. Mm-hmm. We have to think about them in terms of how do they affect us as individuals. So I criticize the kind of easy answers, which are in my mind really not good answers. They're turning to politics to solve problems that I think are fundamentally unique to each and every individual.
Who were some of the more influential modern feminists, and what have they said about the relationship between career and motherhood?
Well, there are many, many people writing about this right now. One of the most famous wrote an essay in the Atlantic Monthly, and I think it was last year, her name is Anne-Marie Slaughter, and it was called Why Women Still Can't Have It All. And she detailed her own story, very well written, about she had been a dean, professor and dean at Princeton University, and then she went down to Washington to work for Hillary Clinton in the State Department. And after about a year of this, she realized, you know, I cannot be the mother I want to be for my children and work for Hillary Clinton in the State Department. It's just simply too demanding a job. Even a great, as great a boss as Hillary Clinton is, I can't do this. And so she quit. And she wrote this essay and said, you know, women still can't have it all. But the outcome of that essay, or the prescription for that essay, is that, well, we need to get the political representation of women right. And that's part of what I'm reacting to. And there are many other women writing things along these lines. Deborah Spar has written a new book called Wonder Women, something about women in quest for perfection. There are others as well. A lot of very high-profile women, especially in academia, who are writing these essays. And they have good things to say, but as I've already said, I think they're not really seeing the full picture.
You know, I wonder in some ways if it's almost gets back to one's worldview, you know, basic assumptions. For example, some of these people probably buy into the notion of evolution in the macro evolution sense of the word. There is no God. We're just a product of chance. And some of our views about motherhood and about women versus men or whatever, these are just culturally derived, but there's nothing natural built into the inherent created order, whereas the Christian worldview is, well, we are endowed by our Creator, and he has made us a certain way, and he's made male, and he's made female, and we complement each other, and we need each other, but there are differences, and that's okay, because that's the way he's made it. Worldviews in conflict, really.
Yes, I think that's right, and I also think you've really hit on something crucial here, which I had failed to bring up in our discussion here, which is that there is a notion among many feminist writers that men and women are interchangeable in certain respects. Obviously, women can only have children, and they admit that. But there's the idea that, well, it would be just as easy for most men to stay home as it is for most women, which is to say that men and women are essentially interchangeable. The differences between us are culturally and socially conditioned. And if we could just get men to act right, this runs through their literature, that like if men would do more, then women would be able to do more professionally. And I also, frankly, don't think that's quite right. I mean, I can't cite a lot of empirical evidence to back this up, but it is certainly the case in my own experience that men and women have different attitudes toward children, toward nurture, and most women are more inclined toward nurture than most men. Now, are there exceptions? Of course. Of course, there always will be. But I think you're pointing to some natural differences that most Christians are comfortable in assuming, and many people who are not Christian would say are not real. And I think they're not quite right about that.
Now, there's only so many hours in a day. The older I get, and I'm 57, by the way, the more I realize, wow, I just can't do everything I want to do. It must be really hard for a young mother who's also out in the working force.
Yes, I do think that's true, and I certainly feel that myself. And actually, I've had several readers of the essay I wrote write and say, you know, what you're describing is a conflict that has to do with time more than anything else. I mean, you may want to be a wonderful mother or father and also be successful in the workplace, but what it comes down to is there are only 24 hours in the day, and if you fully pursue one of those things to its ultimate end, you probably will not have time to fully pursue the other to its ultimate end. In fact, you won't. And
right.
That's what I'm saying in the essay, that, you know, we can talk all we want about balance, and we can achieve a certain kind of balance, but very many of us see, you know, that each of these endeavors is fully worthy of all our time, and that's frustrating because we want to do both well. And I think that really lies at the heart of this conflict over work and family, in a way that's not going away. We're never going to get more time than we already have. So I think you're absolutely right to point that out.
Barbara Bush, when she was when her husband George H.W. Bush was in the White House, she was asked to speak at Wellesley College. There was a big a lot of people protesting that, but she still was able to do it, and she spoke. And one of the things she said, speaking mostly to women graduates, You will never regret at the end of your life when you're just about to die, time spent with your spouse, with your family members, with your friends. You will not regret that time spent building relationships. But will you regret, you know, oh, you didn't take on that extra case, or you didn't write that extra book, or you didn't write, you know, that extra essay? Maybe you won't forget about those, or maybe you'll forget about those things when you're in your deathbed. But those relationships we have, especially with our family, those you won't forget.
Mm-hmm. I think she's quite right about that, and I think she was quite brave to say that at a place like Wellesley, which is, of course, a premier women's college, you know, one of the best places to go in the United States if you're a young, aspiring woman, academic, professional of any kind. The danger in going to schools like this, and I did go to one as an undergraduate, I went to Oberlin College, is that there's such a focus there on achievement and on writing the extra book and on taking on the extra case and doing all the things you're talking about, that becomes kind of the end-all, be-all of life. And that's what so many of these feminist writers are saying. You know, we want to do more and more and more and more. And Barbara Bush is kind of a refreshing corrective to that, saying, well, that's fine, and do some of that, but don't forget what else is important, because these things will stay with you in a way that probably your career won't. You will likely die and be forgotten.
Yeah.
And it would do us all a lot of good to remember that and focus on the things that are, in a certain sense, certainly in a Christian sense, eternally important.
Now, in your own life, you say your children are 8 and 6. What did you do when they were just babies?
When they were young?
Yeah, when they were babies.
Sure. Well, here is the beauty of the academic life. You have a tremendous amount of flexibility. I was not teaching full-time at Baylor when they were first born, so I could stay home. And then when my second child was born, I did start teaching, and I would teach 2 days a week, and I was home the other three. So there are certain careers that are quite forgiving for women who do want to work. I would say academics is probably foremost among them. Certainly other things like if you had your own small business and you could run it out of your home, that would also be a way of doing this. But academics, you have quite a lot of flexibility. So I was able to balance it that way. Nobody really minds if I'm not in the office. As long as I'm getting my work done, then I'm able to do it wherever. So I have to say I was kind of lucky there.
Hmm. Very good. All right, we're talking right now with Elizabeth Corey of Baylor University, and she wrote an article that's in firstthings.com, and I guess the article is called No Happy Harmony, and you're talking about really balancing motherhood and then also working. Now, you described the conflict between the pursuit of professional achievement and the demands of motherhood as tragic, and the question is, in what sense?
Well, that's a good question, too. You know, this is something I've received some questions about, too. You say, that people have said, well, you're saying this is tragic, and yet you're doing this. Well, I mean tragic not so much in the sense of the modern sense of, well, this is a terrible thing or this is very bad. In fact, I don't really mean it that way at all. I mean it in the sense of, in the way Greek tragedy, for instance, two different characters held two goods to be of utmost importance, but they were different. So, for example, I think of the famous tragedy, the Agamemnon, where Clytemnestra, the queen, holds family to be the highest good, and her husband holds the state, he's a king, to be the highest good. And these things clash, and only one can win out. And that's the sense of tragedy I'm using when I'm talking about this is a tragic situation, that modern women very often hold professional achievement and career as a real good, and they should, I mean, because these are goods. But then they also simultaneously hold the good of being a mother, being a family, devoting oneself to other people. That's also, a tremendously important good. And the tragedy I'm pointing to is when these things clash, as they will. And to not recognize that kind of tragedy, I think, is to kind of miss the point in a way that I'm frankly accusing a lot of the contemporary writers of doing. So that's really the sense of tragedy I mean.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting, too, when you look at a lot of the feminism today. I mean, so many of them, it's not a matter of, you know, let's say, achieving equality for women or that kind of thing. Many of them are committed to abortion rights. And so it's hard to see how that squares with a biblical worldview. I don't think it does at all.
Well, yes, and that brings up a whole host of other issues. I mean, one way of understanding that commitment to abortion rights is, of course, that's the ultimate act of self-determination. If you do not want to be a mother, then you do not have to be. And from a Christian perspective, obviously, that's tremendously problematic. You don't even have to be a Christian to find it problematic.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a way of establishing a kind of autonomy and freedom and ability to do the things you want to do at whatever cost. And so, you know, not to divert off into the subject of abortion, but sure, that's become one of those topics that I think feminism has rallied around to in a way that's really probably detrimental in the long term.
Sure. Well, I mean, Mother Teresa once said, if we accept that a mother can kill even her own child, how can we tell others not to kill one another? I mean, very profound question. Let me ask you this. Who owns the children? Remember there was a professor a couple months ago that implied that, well, you know, I think we need to get away from this idea that the parents are the main ones who are going to deal with the education of their children or, you know, oversee the education of their children. There was sort of this implied snug, well, we know better. Really? You do? No, you don't.
Well, yes, and this is extremely problematic, and I would characterize it as a kind of political overreach of the worst kind, that the notion that the state knows better what we ought to be doing with our children than we do. Even as I say that, though, I'm brought up short by the fact that, well, there are a lot of people out there who seem to be doing a not very responsible job of raising their children. You could be sympathetic to those people who would say, well, they, you know, underprivileged kids need X opportunity and they need this advantage and they need, you know, they need the state to step in and give them the things that good parents would give them. Because as they're seeing, there are a lot of parents out there who don't do a good job. Nevertheless, I am extremely skeptical, as it sounds like you are too, about the notion that other people or the state in particular ought to tell us how to raise our kids, because who has the interest in the children really in mind? It's usually the parents, and they have the closest interaction with the children. They know what's best for them, or they ought to. Of course, that's the ideal.
Sure.
I mean, that's a tough problem.
Okay, we only have 30 seconds left. What would you like to say in conclusion?
Well, I'd like to thank you for having me on, and I hope that the readers might want to go and check out the essay, which is on firstthings.com, No Happy Harmony. It's in the October issue. The main thing I would just emphasize is that, you know, this is something that needs to be thought about carefully by young women, especially those young women who are embarking on careers and perhaps on families, too, and to think about it carefully.
All right. Thank you again, Professor Elizabeth Corey from Baylor University. God bless and all the best.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you now. Bye-bye.